Welcome to Geared for Growth. I'm your host, Mike Mortlock from MCG Quantity Surveyors, the tax depreciation experts. Today, we're talking to someone who will pop up in the property industry, but at the time of recording is outside of the main game. He is Max Jennings. Now, this is the story of a multi-property portfolio owner who started his working career at McDonald's at 14, and at 18, still working at McDonald's, he purchased his first investment property. Now, Max has gone on to own 4 investment properties, all with his own savings. He's yet to use equity. So we have a chat to him about how he was able to actually achieve that. Are his results replicable today, or was he just lucky, or were the properties cheap when he got them and it's just not something that people can do today? And he gives us some really good insights into money and savings and his mindset around patience and essentially pleasure delaying. It's an awesome interview with Max, a very inspirational bloke, and I'm sure you're going to get something out of his mindset and the way that he's gone about it. Here's Max. Max Jennings, thanks for joining me on Geared for Growth.
Thank you for having me.
I've been looking forward to this story for quite some time because you sort of break the general mold that we've had on the show for a little while, which where we're talking to property professionals. Now, I don't want to give away anything, but that's sort of the trajectory that you're heading in. But for now, at least, at the time of recording, you don't work in the property industry. In fact, you've been working at McDonald's, which is not necessarily known as a high salary style occupation, unless you're in corporate, where I assume they're on the mega bucks. But you've actually been able to grow a portfolio of 4 properties. And I'm guessing that there's a lot of people that want to pick your brain to see how you've actually achieved that. So start us off with the Macca's journey. How old were you when you started there?
So I started at 14 years old.
Right.
Right in about October. And then from there, moved up the ranks into crew trainer in about a year or so after that. And then when I was 18, I became a manager. I didn't want to do – I had guaranteed entry into uni, but I didn't want to use it because I was not sure if I actually even wanted to do it. So I stayed at McDonald's for a year just to see, test the water and see if I liked it. I became a department manager and then stayed right up until about now.
And how old are you at the moment, Max?
So 21.
21. So, yeah. I mean, of course, McDonald's is all about that trajectory. I've done a lot of asset registers on McDonald's. So I've seen a lot of things behind the scenes. Yeah, with, you know, all of the all of the different pathways that they have. And it does seem like very heavily focused towards being a career rather than just a job, which maybe a lot of people see it as an entry-level thing and they move on to bigger and better things. But to progress through the organization that quickly, you know, what do you put that down to?
Hard work, effort, giving 110%.
Yep.
I mean, you get what you put in. So very much is that.
Now, old sort of bitter people like myself would say, well, that's not a millennial thing. You're breaking the mold. What was it about you that made you a grafter? You know, typically people that are of your age that are willing to put that much work in, you know, grow up with adversity, or they might come from another culture where, you know, working hard is ingrained in who they are. What's your makeup?
Well, I suppose my parents, they pushed me to work hard as well, but I also pushed myself. So I think I had the drive as well because there was the property there that I was trying to achieve, especially from 18 onwards. Mm-hmm. And even I'd say 17, like I knew I wanted to buy a property, at least my first one. I don't think I saw the scope for how many I'd have by now. Certainly from 18, I knew what I was going to achieve. Just it was a matter of time really and waiting and being patient.
Yep.
So I think I had it's like dangling the carrot. So I knew what I wanted and I was just like, all right, McDonald's is giving me income. I'm saving X amount and this is the easiest way to do it right now.
And what sort of income are we talking and how were you able to save? Because I mean, even at the sort of the crew trainer level, I'm assuming we're not talking mega bucks.
No. So like when I was 14 to 18, like there was not a huge amount of expenses. So that definitely led to me saving a lot more on a lower income.
Yep.
So I can't remember how much I was on back then, but I know from about manager level onwards, it was around about the 50 to 70 mark.
Yep.
definitely like closer to when I am now at 70. Yep. So that was from, because you just work more hours when you get more experience as a department manager anyway. Yep. And then from that, I think I only spent about, I think my minimum expenses is like 14,000 a year, and it can go up to like, I think 20, depends if, I don't know, I think if I exclude some expenses that aren't really like typical expenses yep. that I can just cut out if I want.
Yeah, yeah.
So it depends how conservative I am.
Yeah, right. And so presumably living at home, so that cuts down on the housing expenses.
Yeah, but I still pay board. It's still a fifth. You know, if I roomed with five other mates, it would be exactly the same.
Right, yeah, yeah. So, you know, I'm obviously devil's advocate going like, all right, how is this not relatable to other people? And trying to make you an outlier 1% to sort of diminish all of your results in this nasty devil's advocate way that interviewers do. All right, so how old were you when you got the first one?
I was 18.
18, right. And yep. So what sort of savings did you have? Did you have more than a 10% deposit?
So I had more than 10%, yeah. So I did, I think it was 195, and I did a 49,000 deposit, I think. And then it was like plus whatever the actual deposit was, so whatever that number is. I just remember how much I had to have in the account at settlement. So 49,000 was that. And then, but I had 60,000 available to spend.
Yep.
And I didn't need it all, so I kept some of it as a buffer. I just didn't want to pay LMI. That was the main thing.
Yeah.
Can't remember. I think I just didn't want to get extra cost.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough.
And then, yeah. Second one, I ended up paying LMI, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, LMI is one of those things where you can look at it as just a completely sunk cost and it's unnecessary. But I think as your sophistication grows, you realize, well, can I write that off against actually getting into something a bit quicker? Will I be able to make enough money to make that sort of LMI impost disappear?
I mean, you can claim some of the borrowing costs over 5 years anyway, so it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. So talk us through that first investment. So 195, that's going to be, I'm assuming, a bit of a cheap and cheerful style property. Which state? Describe it for us.
So it's a masonette type house, and it's like a duplex. And this is the side that it didn't have as nice a roof, but there was only a small little repair that had to be done on that. So I knew that on the outset when I was buying it, because Mum and I inspected the property on the family holiday. Yep. And then we had gone in, looked around, and we're like, okay. And the tenant was there as well. So we could see, okay, this guy's really good. You know, you can sometimes get that vibe from people. We had gone to other properties and we sort of felt the, don't know if I'm going to be able to keep you for too long or whatever. He was very, very, very good. And I've still got him. So clearly very good. Yep. 3 years later. And then structurally, everything was nice. The building was presented really well. He looked after it really well. The rent was good. So we're achieving an 8% yield on purchase. And the building for its age was actually pretty good quality.
Yep.
Like nothing was really bad, and it still is going pretty good. So that was more so what I was looking at. I was looking at the yield.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I was also looking to make sure the house wasn't a ruins either. Like,
yeah.
So long as it could survive.
I've heard a little bit of previous interviews that you've done on other podcasts, and it seems like there's a yield minimum that's embedded part of your strategy. Now, I want to ask you about that, but I want to also figure out, was that something that you took into that first one or something that you figured out?
That was from day dot, yeah.
Yep.
Because I distinctly remember when I was driving around for number two that I was looking through, like, I think it's like, you know, those catalogs where you have all the properties in them and you look along. Yeah. I was calculating just in my head and on phone when it was a bit harder numbers, like just the 8% is to find where they were rough guides. Cause I don't want to look at a 6%, especially in like the suburb I'm looking at. You look at, you know, suburbs have certain averages, and if you know what you can achieve, why would you achieve less?
Hmm. Well, I'm going to try and answer that. 6% is actually quite a high yield at the moment. And I, you know, people will say, well, it's a payoff. You either choose something that has capital growth or you choose something that has yield. You can't really have both. I think that's up for debate. I think you definitely can. I think that if you look at a lower yielding property versus a high yielding property, it might be safe to say the lower yielding would have greater capital growth potential. But how much did that come into your mindset is that, okay, I want to be a multi-portfolio investor, so I'm going to need some growth. Otherwise, saving for a deposit is going to be a very slow trajectory.
And that's what I mean. Like, asset selection is important. So because of my income as well, I believe that 8% was a really good point to be at, because then the holding was easy. You know, it's all well and good to buy properties, but if you can't hold them, there's no point.
Exactly.
And the selling costs are quite, incredible sometimes, especially if it's in such a short time frame as well, because you have to if you're distressed.
Yes.
So holding them was important, and 8% gave me that ability to hold them and then have profit after as well.
Yep.
And then it was just a matter of finding not the worst property at 8%, but finding some of the best properties at 8%. Because my first one, I bought it at 195 and it's now valued at 300.
Right. So you got growth. And that's definitely what, growth. 6 years?
No, 3 years.
3 years. Okay, right.
I'm going to be 6 years. I'm 21.
Yeah. I thought you said 24. Okay. 3 years. Well, I mean, that's, I can't do those numbers in my head. I need your smartphone.
It's a little bit.
That's a little bit. That's pretty good. Now, how much of that was luck, do you think? Or how much do you think that was analysis and I fully expected that to happen?
No, I definitely think a lot of it was like analysis, because I looked at the area it was in. So it's right near a primary school.
Yep.
It's on a good side street where it's quiet and it's nice. All the other, surrounding buildings aren't awful either. And it's in a desired spot. It's one of the nicer primary schools. And interestingly enough, the crime rates on that side in that specific street are actually far lower than the other side, which is adjacent, but like it's separated by a block of shops or whatever. So it's geographically insignificant, really.
Yeah.
But basically, the other side. Yeah, well, that's right. Like the other side, you look at the rents you can get on that side, you get them. There's a lot of higher vacancy. And the other side, people don't want to be. So they're often like, if as soon as I can get out, I'll move. Whereas the other side, that's where families are staying. That's where people who want to not be criminals stay.
Yeah.
So, and you can often charge a higher rent on that side, and it's worthwhile.
Yep. So with the second acquisition, was that an equity play or was there additional savings?
That was savings again.
Yeah, right. So that was, no equity at 19. All. Yep.
No, so I haven't used equity yet.
Right. Okay, there you go. So you continued the savings. Now, I mean, that's a little bit unusual for someone of your generation. Gosh, it makes me feel old saying words like that. I still feel young and sprightly to some degree, but I mean, tell that to my hips and lower back. But in some respects, it's a harder generation to be patient and to save, because things that are available to you weren't available to me growing up. Afterpay, iPhones, there wasn't as much competition for the youth dollar, right? And you've only got to look at people like Taylor Swift to realize that, all the money's in teenage girls apparently. But how did you contrast sort of your spending and saving habits to your mates? Were you in a good group where everyone was kind of doing the same stuff, or did you get a little bit left behind because Max, he's not going to want to go out because he's too frugal?
My mates are a really good bunch. So we're still very close at high school onwards. I think there's about 8 or 12 of us.
Yep.
We still regularly catch up. I think back then, some of them didn't have jobs, so their savings weren't really – I mean, they didn't have the income to even save, so that didn't help.
Yep.
But their mindsets are still very much the same. They're not on the same level as me yet, but I think I've had quite the head start as well. From 14, boom, that's when I had my mindset.
Yep.
And then I've just, continued that. I've just had time on my side, right? They talk about compound interest for 7 years and then you really get the snowball happening. I'm at 7 years now, so I've had quite the snowball, but they have definitely started now. I've definitely helped a couple of my mates help start some saving plans and whatever. Now I think one of them's at 8,000 saved, someone's at probably a bit more than that.
Yeah, excellent. Well, that's good that you're a good influence on them. So
yeah, that's probably a better influence on them than they are on me, but at least in the finance world. So
yeah, someone's got to be the best. Now, it begs the question, why? What was that plan that you had in your head when you were 14? Obviously, you were already being quite diligent with your savings, and you stayed the course, you talked about patience. So what were you being patient for today that you're looking at as the goal in the future? What does that look like for you? What are you trying to achieve?
The Geared for Growth Property Investing Podcast is presented by our business, MCG Quantity Surveyors. If you're an investor or a property professional looking to get the best tax depreciation deductions for yourself or your clients, please get in touch with us at mcgqs.com.au. It's our mission to help as many property investors as we can to maximize their claims and maximize their property education as well.
I think now I'm more crystal clear on what I want, but even then, like, the crystal clear is like a murky crystal clear. Like, because 14, it's hard to say what I truly wanted. I think I wanted to buy my own house at 18, because when I was hired, the lady who hired me had bought her own home. Like, that was my hiring manager. Yeah. And I was like, well, at McDonald's, you've already bought one. She's like, yeah. And I mean, I think now she's paid it off. But like, my point is, at 14, that was what I saw. I was like, okay, cool. So if I'm at McDonald's, this is exactly what I can do. So why not?
Yeah.
If I start now, I'll be able to do it easy.
Yep.
And having a house, I mean, that's generally a paid off house is one of the biggest success indicators of retirement, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
So I could definitely do that, what, at 18, boom. Yeah. Retirement will be easy. And you have more time to do things then, whatever it is. So that was probably my outlook at 14. 15, 16, about the same. 17, I sort of looked into shares because one of my 18-year-old mates from work had dabbled in it. Mm-hmm. And then we had dabbled in that in biology class with one of my friends as well. That didn't go as well as my property has. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I'll play with that a lot. But it's still there. Like, some of them I hold still. So it's not awful.
Yeah.
But then 18, I really had a perspective shift that I wanted generational wealth, because when I was an accountant, I could see, you know, how really successful clients had made portfolios, and you could see what they're doing, what sort of cash flow they're achieving, what numbers they're achieving.
Yep.
And it's inspiring. Mm-hmm. So you can see, okay, I'm at 18. I've got all this money saved up now. I had 60,000 saved up. Excellent. Let's take some action. Let's make it work.
Yeah. And what about today? What does the goal look like for you? Paid off home, early retirement. What are you chasing?
I think the freedom of early retirement, being able to do it, is probably more powerful than actually doing it. Because I think I enjoy working with what I'm doing and what I will be doing. So it's not the necessity to retire, because that's a bit empty, but being able to and having the freedom to choose, you know what, I have no financial hardship possible in this amount of years or whatever it is, that has a lot of power to it. So it's more freedom for me to be able to make a risky decision. So, you know, some people might feel like investing in a regional area isn't risky investment, but if you have the financial backing to do it, you can make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Or if you lose a little bit of money, you're not that worse off.
Yeah. I had someone describe money to me as freedom tickets, and I've kept that up. I think that's the best way to think about money. For me, it's not necessarily I want the things or I want to be retired. It's just more like I want the freedom to be able to swap the freedom ticket for what freedom is to me. You know, take
or make lots of properties that print freedom tickets.
There you go. Exactly. Now, I'm going to go and be that nasty devil's advocate again.
Thanks.
Yeah, no, at least I've warned you. Now, there would be people, let's talk about, say, a generation, well, half a generation prior to you. There's a lot of people that are in sort of the property space or in the media saying, you know, I have 30, I have 50, I have 100 properties. But the lending environment was very different then. It was a lot easier to borrow for investments, and they, you know, you would have to say many of them are beneficiaries of that past environment that sort of got them a start where they've got that, you know, momentum that you talked about before, and perhaps not all of that is replicable. Now, they might argue with me on that. That's another show. But when it comes to yourself, you know, you're talking about an 8% yield property for 195. There might be someone who's 14 or 18 or 30 looking at their first investment property and going, well, it's all very well for Max, but an 8% yield property at $195,000 just doesn't exist in anywhere that I'm not going to get shot in the face while I'm inspecting it. What would you say to those people?
I say they're wrong because it's we have to challenge our preconceptions. That's the thing, because if you're going to – so some investors, they like to invest where they are. That's fine. Like, you know, there's strategies to everything. I'm not saying mine's the only successful route either. Like, I could have invested in, you know, Metro Adelaide, and that could have been successful too, albeit slower because I didn't have the capital to do it very quickly. I wouldn't have had the amount of assets. And sometimes, you know, it's better to have lots of eggs than just one egg doing the work, right? Mm. So that way, because you can, you know, your diversification is one thing, but having four lots of diversification and they're all making their own growth, that does work as well, provided you're not losing them.
Yeah.
And no. They were inexpensive to hold. I was making profit on them.
Yeah, yeah.
So the regional area I was investing in, it was like, okay, well, it's not too risky. And I simply looked at suburb data, and then when I looked at the suburb, I saw the yield. You know, I am a little bit of a devil advocate for myself as well. And I looked at the crime data, and that's how I found the street. So you look at suburb, then street level, you find the least bad street.
Yep.
And you look at, then when we actually went there, we found, okay, it's really not that bad. So then you confirm what you're thinking as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. I'm glad you argued with me, because it would have been a pretty ordinary show. If you just, no, I agree, Mike. Like, this is all just luck. And no,
yeah, I flipped a coin.
So let's talk about the next property and the next property after that for you. I mean, the strategy has obviously been so far, you know, save the money, get a deposit, go again. You haven't used equity as yet, which means that you've got some capacity there, and that could be the next one, or it won't be. But I want to talk about, well, where's your head at with what you've learned? Obviously, you've been consuming property information for quite some time, even before the first one, and you've got some experience with the four acquisitions. Has anything changed about your strategy? And what is that typical sort of investment grade property like from a definition point for you now?
I definitely think I'm more hooked towards commercial now.
Yep.
From the second one onwards, I was definitely – so once I bought the second one, I was immediately like, cool, let's buy the third. Yeah. The buying process is the most fun for me. I could have 50 properties tomorrow and it would be probably not fun. But I'd love it, but it's, you know, the buying part's the fun part,
yep.
At least for me anyway. And cash flow is great. But when I got the second, I wanted the third. And I was still in that resi mindset that's very limiting. So I was looking for another resi one, and my borrowing capacity just simply wasn't there because resis already have that negative gear buffer the banks love to put on it.
Yeah.
No matter how positively geared I then, I mean, it's probably a good decision anyway because, you know, 19 at the time and interest rates were going up at that time. So probably a safe decision in all things considered. Nothing I could have controlled, interest rates and anything like that. Mm. But certainly I'm glad that they didn't let me buy another resi. Because I could have, but it would just taken more capital and I'd have less of a loan. So the leverage would have been different. But the commercial, I need 30%, so there's still the cash for that. So then my brother and I did a JV for that and we bought that one. And insane cash flow because all the outgoings are paid. Mm. And then that instantly, obviously before purchasing, I'd done heaps and heaps of research from, I think, property one about commercial because, you know, you hear about the buzzword commercial property and you hear about net yield rather than gross yield, and you're like, okay, I'm hooked. Yeah. Tell me more, please, where I don't have to pay more money.
That's kind of enough, isn't it? You're like, oh, you know, it's, you know, 6% yield, and they're like, oh, no, that's net. You're like, what?
and my commercials were net 8% yields.
Oh, my God. And then addicted to 8%.
Yeah. Actually, my first one was a 9.5% net yield, if we're real specific. But
well, there's no need to show off, Max.
the second one was actually an 8%. So I'll average it down to like 9-ish.
So maybe just under. So the first one was the resi sort of duplex style 195. And the second and third were commercial. Is that what you were saying?
No. So the second one was a corner block resi.
Yep.
That was just a standalone house. And I really like the corner block because that's generally sought after as well. And isn't it a similar spot to the first one? Mm-hmm. So I knew that the growth would be probably around the same mark. It was actually cheaper than the first one anyway. It was at 185 instead of 195.
Yep.
Yeah, right. So the growth from that has been proportionally bigger, but the dollar value is less.
Yep. So the fifth, sixth, seventh property, whatever, wherever you decide to get to, your mindset is now in the commercial side of things. Oh,
unless there was a resi deal that I did, like say I did a reno or something and I want to just have play money, maybe that's what I did. But for now, the foreseeable future is commercial because the cash flow, the growth I get from it is just unparalleled for resi. I don't see myself doing it. The numbers don't stack up as much.
Yeah, excellent.
And then there's also an opportunity cost. If I don't buy commercial now, they're going to be more sought after later and they're going to be of a higher value. The cash flow is going to be worthless. So there's that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, commercial buyers agents sort of didn't exist
not that long ago.
And yeah, now it's more of a thing. So I think you're right. It's becoming more and more popular. Mm. All right, Max, we have to end at some point. I mean, I feel like we could talk for another hour or so, but for anyone that's listening, I think they would be annoyed at me if I didn't try and put a little bit of a bow around this episode by saying, for the people that are the aspirational investors that are listening and maybe they're looking at their first, they're saving, or perhaps they've got the one, but they do want to be a multi-portfolio investor, what are, say, the biggest three tips that you would have that you've learned to be able to get to where you are so quickly?
These three probably aren't, they're not for everyone, but for sure they helped me. So I'll say what they are. First one would be cash flow. Mm-hmm. Cash flow was vital to mine because I didn't have the income to, you know, sell it if I was distressed. There was not going to be there would not be four properties if one of them had to go down. So the cash flow and the feasibility studies I did beforehand on the spreadsheet, you know, like the rental schedules you get for your tax return, simply that entered the numbers I wanted. And I could play from 1% gross yields all the way up to, you know, unachievable, almost 15% yields. And then I just found the middle ground for me, which was 8% at the price point I could achieve, right? Yep. You know, had I been able to afford more, maybe I would have gone for a more conservative 6 or 5 or 4. Mm-hmm. But, and I would have, you know, probably got more growth potentially. Who knows, right? Growth is a bit of a flip a coin sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But unless, of course, you manufacture it. But, you know, 8% at that price point, I could achieve. So I think finding what your goals are and trying to just get the ball rolling, you can't wait for the perfect property. You know, the best time to buy a property was yesterday. So it truly is that sometimes that in my circumstance, I could get an 8% yield, which is great for cash flow. Tick on that box. It was at the price point I wanted. Tick on that box. And then it was just a matter of doing it and finding a property.
Yep.
So that was probably the first one. The second one is, like, I think it's definitely about not cross-collateralizing your loans,
right,
trying to maintain each property as it is. So moving forward now, 1, 2, 3, 4, they've all been separate. Mm-hmm. The next fifth one, I'm probably going to pull some equity out of the two resis because they simply just aren't. I mean, out of all the assets I have, they're the lazy assets. So why not just, and that, lazy is like they're running marathons still, but like they're not running fast enough in my standards. So I'll use their equity and I won't cross-collateralize. I'll just buy another commercial.
Yep.
So leverage is definitely a tool to use, but also be safe with it. Don't be crazy.
Yep.
Like there's a cost to leveraging.
Buffer, right?
Yeah. Like I have a buffer on every property.
Yep. I think that's very
sensible. And then the third one I would say is definitely comes back to that buffering stuff is you need the financial like structures around you to do things. And I don't mean entities. I mean like actual the bricks and mortar almost to your own budget, right? You need to be sure of how you do things. If you were given $10,000 right now as a pay slip, what would you do with it regardless of how much money it was? Mm-hmm. For me, I'm going to pay all my normal expenses and then save.
Yep.
Boom. And then I'll do that every single time, no matter how much money comes through the door. So I could be on a $100 billion salary and I'd probably just buy properties faster. It wouldn't be anything different. Like there'd be no lifestyle inflation there.
I think if you're on $100 billion, I at least want you to take me out to lunch.
But yeah, see, I can do that. You know, we could splurge a little bit there.
At $100 billion, you can probably afford to buy those typical bad investments like a jet ski. But
my point is, like, you need to at least be able to avoid the temptation to know, hey, look, I don't have to just because, you know, a dollar rolled towards me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, look, I'm obviously making fun, but I think that that discipline is important. And I think that's where we get in trouble as individuals. We get a pay rise and that money doesn't go into savings. It just goes into meeting our higher expectations of how we should live. I've talked about it in the podcast before. It's like when I started working, you know, I'd buy a $16 bottle of wine and then suddenly it gets to $28 and it's like, oh, okay, I can see where I've gone wrong there. And that's I think that's a natural human thing. And you figured that out pretty quick, and I think that's been quite
and I'm not to immune to it. That's not to say I won't buy myself nice things, but it is being knowledgeable of what you're buying at least. So that way you can have the things you know, you can have both things you want. Just like one requires a bit more sacrifice, but you still want it. It's just a different kind of one. It's more one of those long-term ones. If I'm buying a property every year, I can't spend my savings. Like that's definitely something I'm not doing, but I'll budget X amount of dollars to make sure I'm still having fun and doing the things I want to do because I'm young. Like there's things I want to do. So I'll go on a holiday at least once a year, things like that. So you can budget for those and just divide it by 52, boom. In 52 weeks time or however many weeks time, there's your little prize. But you're not taking away from the overall prize of having lots of properties to retire yourself.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, even just saying, okay, this is in the budget, the holiday, I divided by 52. It becomes a very small number each week.
Absolutely.
To put that away, right?
Well, if it's 2 years, even smaller, like you can make it any number, you know? If it's a goal that's closer, like 12 weeks away, say, you know, it's going to be a bigger number, but it's still less than if you waited to the day you had to pay it.
Yeah, yeah, awesome. Look, I think those three tips are fantastic, and I think you should be congratulated on your discipline and your success to date. We look forward to seeing you pop up in the next venture, which we're not going to spoil on this episode. We'll leave that up to you, but wish you all the success in the future and hope to get you back down the track to check in to see where you're at.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Max. Cheers.